their units and everybody. Good morning. I'm sure you know, honorable members, that I'm a new person in the committee after 2-3 months, not forming part of yourself, but nonetheless, I'm happy to find you still intact. Realizing that it's a committee week, many of our honorable members are on oversight, but the fact that the work that we'll be doing today does not require a quorum. We will be briefed by the stakeholders, namely the Justice Department and the Treasury. Government pension fund, you know, unit, because we'll be dealing with the issue relating to special petition. Of course, honorable members, we have been allocated the new secretariat, and we are bidding farewell to Barbara, whom she is sitting at the back today. So I'm not sure whether it was deliberately made a gentleman of all of that. Coming back of myself, then there should be people who are moving out of the committee. But nonetheless, at the same time, we are welcoming a new secretary, Ayanda Boss. She will be working with us from now forth. Barbara, go well to wherever you will be going. And if things doesn't go well, don't hesitate to say to them, I'm going back to my home. That's your home in any way, you belong here. Nonetheless, may you are welcome. We hope you will fit into the big size of Barbara. If you don't fit, get liaison and tighten them so that they fit you equally. I've been noticed that we did receive a letter from IDASA as a follow-up of what happened 2-3 months down the line when IDASA wanted to act on behalf of one of honorable members from ID in Parliament about the way we have run that thing. I've since requested Barbara, and I'm sure she communicated to Ayanda, that the letter be circulated amongst ourselves and to look into it in the next meeting. The other issues that are required to be remarked on is a decision towards the Honorable Davidson proposal for EPIC Act. Where we have since made inquiries, and today it looks like nothing has been on board as promised by those who presented to us in the last meeting. And equally, I'm sure also the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development also promised us that they are working on something related to that somewhere in April. To date, nothing has been coming forward. If a representative of the department present here had any ideas, they may remark on it as to how far is this particular commitment by them to us in April that they will be having something soon. Having said all this, our agenda items are very straightforward. Can we first check on apologies? Who apologized?
Good morning, honorable members. We've got apologies from Honorable Monebazi, Honorable Van Lake, Honorable Pretorius, Honorable Sarah Blanche, Honorable Killian, Honorable Orian Ambrosini, and Honorable Smith. Thank you.
There you are. those are the members that have apologized. Welcome, Honorable Sosibo. Yeah. No, we'll talk other things after this, because I've remarked about myself being a new person, seeing you a new person also. There are many things that I knew in the committee today. Nonetheless, we would now proceed with the agenda item and invite the Treasury to make their presentation. I would want to believe that the what is on the wall belongs to them. Am I correct?
Yes, no. Honourable.
So you can take us through.
Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members of the Committee. My name is Janine Bednar-Giose, and I am the Director of Legislation in the National Treasury. And thank you very much this morning for inviting us to provide a submission to the committee on this application for a special petition for the recognition of a non-pensionable period of service for Ms. Van Rita Van Woodsoorn. I will make an initial presentation, and then my colleague, Mr. Malloy from the Government Pensions Administration Agency, will also make a brief presentation. We will be particularly focusing on the legal issues relating to the petition and also the financial implications relating to the petition. So, to just give a brief factual summary of the matter, Ms. Van Rita was permanently employed by the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development from 1 October 2000, and she retired on 30 June 2010. So that was a period of 9 years and 9 months in total. And she contributed to the government employees' pension funds during that period. And on 12 August last year, she was paid a lump sum payment for the pension aspect of that she was entitled to for a period of service of 9 years and 9 months. And she has made an application, a special petition to this committee, requesting the recognition of a non-pensionable period of service of 3 months, so that she would then have a recognized total period of service of 10 years, and then she would be able to qualify both for a pension annuity as well as a lump sum gratuity payment. So I'll just touch briefly now upon the relevant legislative provisions that are important to consider in relation to this application. So the major legislative provisions that are relevant are the rules of the Government Employees Pension Fund and the Public Service Bargaining Council Resolution Number 1 of 2006. Now the rules of the GEPF, they're applicable in relation to the pension benefits that Ms. Van Rita would be entitled to receive, and the Bargaining Council Resolution is applicable in relation to the medical benefits payment that she would be entitled to receive. So there are two aspects to the benefits that need to be considered in this matter. So first, looking at the rules of the GEPF and the pension benefits, Rule 14.2.1 of the GEPF rules provides that if a member has at least 10 years pensionable service, that member would be paid both a gratuity calculated in accordance with the formula set out in the rule, and also a monthly annuity, would be entitled to receive a monthly annuity. And Rule 14.1.1 provides that if a member has less than 10 years of service, that person would be paid a gratuity pension benefit only, but that lump sum payment is calculated in a slightly different manner than the lump sum that would be payable to a person with more than 10 years service. So it would be a larger lump sum payment, but the person would not be entitled to receive a monthly annuity in that situation. Rule 10.4 of the rules, and this is very important in this matter, this is sort of the crucial rule in relation to this matter, provides that a member may apply to the board of the GEPF to purchase additional service to be recognized as pensionable service. But this rule refers to a member applying, and so that is interpreted as requiring that the application must be made prior to a person exiting the GEPF and leaving the service of the employer. So it is interpreted as not being possible for a person to apply who has already left the GEPF and is no longer a member, defined as a member of the GEPF. Now, in Ms. Fenrita's case, she has already left the GEPF, and so she is now a pensioner, and she is no longer defined as a member. So after you leave the GEPF, then Rule 10.4 does not permit a person who's already left the GEPF to apply for the recognition. That has to be, the person has to make a decision and make the application prior to leaving service. Now, from the documents that have been submitted to the committee, along with the petition, Ms. Van Rieder does state that she is aware that she did serve only 9 years and 9 months of service, and that she was aware that 10 years of service are required in order to be eligible to receive an annuity pension benefit. We had investigated if to confirm if she had perhaps made any application for the recognition of additional service prior to retiring and exiting the GEPF, but we could not find any indication that she did so. And the GEPF and the Government Employees and Pension Administration Agency have confirmed that they had not received any application for the recognition of additional service. So then considering the facts and the provisions relating to the medical benefits, an entitlement to a medical subsidy is governed by the Public Service Council Public Service Coordinating Bargaining Council Resolution Number 1 of 2006. And in terms of that resolution, an employee qualifies for a medical aid subsidy if he or she has 15 years of actual service or 10 years of actual service if the retirement is due to ill health. If an employee has between 10 and 15 years service, they would be entitled to a lump sum medical benefit payment calculated as basically 36 months of the employer's contribution to the medical aid. And if a person has less than 10 years service, the person would be entitled to a lump sum payment of an amount of 12 months of the employer's benefit payment to the medical aid. So there are differing lump sum payments that would be made if a person had less than 15 years service. Now, in the last few weeks since this application petition was referred to the National Treasury and the GEPF and Government Employees Pension Administration Agency, we have been engaging with the Government Employees and Pensions Administration Agency, and they have also been engaging with the petitioner, Ms. Fenrita. And yesterday I was advised that Ms. Fenrita had made an application for a medical subsidy in July last year, and unfortunately there was certain information that was not complete on the application, so they wrote to her on a couple of occasions requesting that additional information, and then they have more recently been engaging with her, and they provided her again with the necessary form to complete for a subsidy, and Yesterday, we were advised that her application for medical subsidy was finalized last week, and it appears from what we've been advised that in addition to the 9 years and 9 months of permanent service that she had, Ms. Vanvita was able to provide additional information regarding some periods of contract work that she did with the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. And so the GPAA has assessed her application and determined that she would be entitled to either receive a lump sum payment or a subsidy, and she was offered the option to choose whether she wanted a subsidy or lump sum payment. And apparently, we've been advised that Ms. Sanrita has opted to receive a subsidy, so she would have two-thirds of the contribution subsidized, and then she would pay in the difference, the one-third amount of the subsidy. And so it seems that an agreement has been reached about handling the medical benefits aspect of her matter, and so it's hoped that this will be completely finalized very quickly, and so that's a positive development in respect of Ms. Benrita's matter. And so we are advised that the GEPF will start, or the GPAA will start making the relevant payments to her current medical aid as soon as they start receiving a valid request for payment from the claims from the medical scheme. Now, in relation to the pension benefits, we inquired, and Mr. Malloy will be able to provide further detail, that there would be some amount, if she was approved to have the recognition of additional service, she would be eligible to receive, to purchase the additional services. Some additional amount was paid by the employee and the employer, and she would also have to repay the gratuity lump sum that she received in August last year, or at least a portion of it. And this will be dealt with in greater detail in Mr. Malloy's presentation. So, in looking at the financial implications regarding this matter, it is very important for the committee to consider both the financial implications arising particularly in respect of Ms. Vanvita's individual matter, as well as broader financial implications that may arise for the GEPF, GPAA, and government if in relation to other applications that may arise if this matter is approved and a precedent is set, if this petition is granted. We're advised that last year Ms. Vanvita was paid a lump sum gratuity of R$194,997, and that was after tax, that came to an amount of R$181,158. And if she purchased the 3 months service prior to her exit from the GEPF, she would receive a gratuity of a lump sum payment of R$52,958, and a monthly annuity would be paid of R$1,244. And according to the calculations that have been made, if Ms. Vanvita retired, has 10 years of more recognized service, then an amount of R$63,974.50. She has already received that benefit, and so she would owe the GEPF in total, according to calculations, an amount of R$131,022 that would have to be repaid to the GEPF. So in relation to the pension benefits, it's quite unclear whether Ms. Vanvita would be able to pay such an amount of R$131,000 back to the GEPF. And if that is the case, it would not be appropriate to require the employer, the GEPF, or the National Revenue Fund to cover such an amount, to pay in that additional amount. And Ms. Van Rita, if in such an instance, would have received an additional substantial benefit to which she was not entitled, because, you know, additional amounts would have been paid into the GEPF beyond what she would have been entitled in relation to other pensioners who have contributed and retired with 10 years of service. So that's a very important consideration in relation to the aspects of Ms. Van Rita's pension benefit. And in addition to the financial implications noted above, it's very important to highlight that additional potentially very substantial financial implications may arise for the government and the GEPF if a precedent is set for the recognition of 3 months additional service for Ms. Van Rita on an ad hoc basis and Parliament passes special legislation to deal specifically with this case. There are potentially a substantial number of other former members of the GEPF who may also be desiring to apply to purchase service after they have left the GEPF, and it would not be it's not possible to accurately quantify the numbers of possible applicants and the total financial implications, but it could be a very significant financial implication that would have significant impacts for the financial situation of the GEPF and also for government. And now I'll particularly focus on the legislative implications. And in relation to the matter of the medical aid benefits appears to have been successfully resolved. So the key issue relates to the provision of pension benefits. And in order for 3 months additional pensionable service to be recognized for Ms. Van Rita, we examined whether it would be possible only just to amend the rules of the GEPF, and we determined that, unfortunately, that would not be possible because Ms. Van Rita has already exited the GEPF, and so the direct relationship between the fund and Ms. Van Rita as a member is no longer in existence. And so in order to recognize the pensionable service, it appears that it would be necessary, the only way that could be recognized would be through special legislation. And there have been instances in the past where special legislation has been passed by Parliament to address a particular petitioner's matter. And most recently that was done in 2008 in the matter of Ms. Kellerman, who petitioned the Committee for the Condemnation of Interrupted Service in respect of her late husband, Advocate Kellerman. And this required that the committee's approval of the condemnation of interrupted service required that a special piece of legislation be developed by the National Treasury and enacted by Parliament, and this was the Government Employees Pension Fund Condemnation of Interrupted Service Act of 2008, Act Number 43 of 2008. And it is undesirable from a practical and a constitutional perspective, it's very undesirable for Parliament to be passing legislation to deal with a matter relating to one specific individual, particularly as in this case, where there are very likely a substantial number of other individuals who have already retired or resigned from the GEPF and would also likely desire an opportunity to apply to purchase additional service. And only Ms. Van Rita would benefit from that legislation, and other persons who may be in a similar situation would not benefit from that legislation. And Section 36 of the Constitution is underpinned, which deals with the limitation of rights, is underpinned by a principle that laws should in general be of a general application, that in the case of limiting rights, you can't just pass a law that limits the rights of a single individual or a very few individuals. And in the spirit that, you know, the law should be applying and benefiting people generally, laws conferring rights and benefits should be of general application. And a law should not be passed which only confers a benefit on a single individual and does not take into, does not address the needs of all similar individuals. And Section 9, Subsection 1 of the Constitution, which deals with equality, the right to equality, emphasizes that everyone has the right to equal protection and benefit of the law. And it's important that these matters, that matters are addressed in a, on a policy basis and in a principled manner, in a, and consistent manner based on appropriate policy and practical consideration, and not on a, on an ad hoc case-specific matter. And so it is very important for the committee to consider this case not only in light of the particular facts of the case and the individual involved. And it is important that, it is a very important principle that the law, in this case, the rules of the GEPF, must be applied consistently so that situations do not arise where some cases would end up receiving preferential treatment in relation to other similarly situated cases. And so if this case is not handled in the manner that takes into consideration the broader context and implications, it could potentially set a very negative precedent that could result in a large number of applications being made to this committee for other cases to be treated on a special basis, and Parliament may find itself dealing with a large number of special petitions to deal with particular individuals. And you know, that would not be a desirable precedent for Parliament to have to deal with, as it would undermine the imperative that the law must address issues in a fair, consistent, and equal manner. So there would be potential precedent implications that would have serious impacts upon Parliament and the work that Parliament is called upon to do. If there is a problem that is identified with the GEP law legislative framework that needs to be rectified, it would be appropriate for the problem to be considered generally in light of policy considerations and the practical implications of implementing a policy change in relation to all similarly situated members or pensioners of the GEPF, and the feasibility of implementing such a change in relation to all relevant members and pensioners. And then it would be important to develop an approach to address the problem in a consistent policy-based manner that would be practically implementable and would deal with the issues on a fair, equal, and consistent basis, and would not deal with the issues on an ad hoc basis that has the potential to create disparities between similarly situated individuals. So I think that those are the important aspects relating to this matter that we would wish to draw to the committee's attention. And if members have any questions, they would be most welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. I think let's invite Dr. Mullery to the fifth, so that when we talk to this, you know, presentation, the approach is a more holistic approach. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Good morning to all honourable members of the committee. My name is Keith Moloi. I'm from the Government Pensions Administration Agency, administering pensions for government employees, pension funds, and medical aid subsidies, special pensions, and so on. My focus with my presentation will be directly linked to the rules that regulate how pension benefits are paid out to members, enunciating on what conditions are certain benefits paid out. As summarized previously, Ms. Van Reede was employed with permanent employee with the Department of Justice on the 1st of October 2000. And she was admitted with the Government Employees Pension Fund on the same day. She retired on the 30th of June 2010 at the age of 65. on that date she had actual service period of 9 years and 9 months as fashionable service. According to our rules, Rule 14.3 states that as to how would pension benefits be determined, and in this case, based on the actual service period of Mr. Agbayeli,
it states that if a member retires with less than 10 years of service, the member is entitled to a gratuity equal to the member's actual interest, that is, in terms of Rule 14.3.2.
However, if a member, can you hear me? However, if a member,
can you turn the
member retires with more than 10 years of service, the member is entitled to a gratuity and an annuity. That is in terms of Rule 14.22 and benefits payable or calculated in terms of 14.3.3. Now, it should be noted that the gratuity paid to those members with more than 10 years is substantially less than the gratuity paid out to those members with less than 10 years of service. As members with more than 10 years is also entitled to an annuity that is payable on a monthly basis up until the date of death. And the actual quantification of benefits will be dealt with later on. I'll just enunciate as to how I will determine. And any member, however, it has been seen that in some instances, members would desire to have a greater period of service than the actual period of service they have with their employer. And in terms of Rule 10.4, a member is allowed to apply to purchase service while still in service as a member of the Government Employees Pension Fund. This legislation relates to medical aid subsidies. Though Janine has already highlighted that the matter has been resolved, but just to give a brief indication, the medical aid subsidies has been provided in terms of the agreement with the bargaining council, the Public Services Coordinated Bargaining Council, which allows a member to who has actual 15 years period of service to qualify for a monthly subsidy on their medical aid subscription. However, if a member has, you can just move on, Jenny. If a member has 10 years of actual service and they have to exit from employment due to ill health, they would also be entitled to a monthly subsidy on the medical aid subscription. In this case, because Mrs. Van Rede had actual 9 years and 9 months pensionable service, she would have not qualified for a monthly subsidy, but based on considerations made by our medical aid section, they gave her options either to pay her a lump sum medical aid subsidy
benefit which is due and payable to any member that has less than the actual 10 years. But in this case, Mrs. Van Rede chose the option to be subsidized on a monthly basis from that lump sum that was due to her. Mrs. Van Rede, while still in service, could have purchased pensionable service in terms of Rule 10.4, and this would have allowed her to have 10 years of recognized pensionable service on the date she retired, that is in June 2010. She would have been entitled to purchase a minimum of 3 months to a maximum of the prescribed years an employee is required to be in service, as long as the years do not exceed under the age of 18. Can move on. Mrs. Van Rede received a gratuity lump sum of 194,997.02. That is prior to tax deduction. And after tax deduction, she received 181,158.96 as a lump sum for her pensionable service period being 9 years and 9 months. If Mrs. Van Rede had purchased 3 months service prior to the exit date, she would have received a lump sum gratuity of 52,958.14, with a monthly annuity of 1,224. Now this just gives us light to illustrate as to members that have served less than 10 years of service receive a greater gratuity than a member that has served more than 10 years of service, because the member that has served more than 10 years of service, they only receive 1/3 of their gratuity, and the rest would be payable as a monthly annuity up until the date of death. If she had retired with more than 10 years of service, she would have received up until, that is the 31st of July this year, a total amount of 63,974.50. This is quantified by considering the 52,958 that she would have initially received as a gratuity payment and annuities from the date of exit up until the 31st, that is from June last year up until the 31st of July this year, being quantified as 11,016.36. This means that she would have been approved, she would have been authorized to approve the purchase of service and Mrs. Van Rede's, at Mrs. Van Rede's exit. However, in this case, because she had already exited from service, we cannot be in a position to allow purchase of service after the exit date. However, if we would put it on money terms, it means that should Mrs. Van Rede want to purchase service now, she would owe us 131,022.52. And this is quantified by considering the 63,000 as a gratuity lump sum and the 11,000 that has considered as a areas in annuity, with this amount being the 131,000 would have to be reimbursed by Mrs. Van Rede to the Government Employees Pension Fund, and thereafter there would still be an additional cost of purchase of service for the actual 3 months that she would want to purchase as well. It should be noted that a lot of members retire each day with less than 10 years of pensionable service, and they would usually receive the gratuity payable only and not any annuity payable. This has been dealt with, however, as stated, that if a member doesn't have the actual 15 years of actual service, they usually do not qualify for medical aid subsidy.
Thank you very much. We seem not to do very well in terms of time, honorable members. I'm going to allow Department of Justice to do a presentation, because if we don't, we might likely not have an opportunity to hear from them. Can I then hand over to Department of Justice? We'll note whatever we wanted clarification so that we do them at the same time. Okay.
Good morning. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. This is just a short presentation of the facts with regard to the information that we have with the Department of Justice. My name is Super Mashele. I'm the HR Senior Manager in the Department of Justice in Mpumalanga. The facts are as follows. I think it's almost the same information that the previous two speakers have been indicated. This Susan Gere van Oostwaren was appointed as an admin clerk with effect from 1 October 2000 in the department of in our department. She was stationed at Magistrate Office of Akersloom. Her date of birth was or is 24 June 1945. We just calculated that on her appointment she was 55 years old and 3 months when we appointed her. Ms. Van Leeuwen Oswarren reached the compulsory retirement age of 65 on 24 June 2010. We received a notice letter from her office, that is Magistrate Bakkerstrom, indicating that she will be the last day of indicating what will be her last day of service. She submitted all her duly completed retirement documents through the office manager to the Human Resource Directorate in the regional office. And then a letter confirming her retirement benefits was issued to her. After the documents were all received, the termination was effected with effect from 30 June 2011. The pension documents were then forwarded to National Treasury for implementation. Ms. Van Rede van Oswarren was terminated on the correct date upon reaching the age of 65, that's 30 June, and the employer made its contribution as from 1 October 2000 until 30 June 2010, which totals to 9 years, 9 months pensionable service. This is what we have as a department, the information that we can provide to this house. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the members, what would we should do to get clarity in all kinds of questions and then to stand in our own time another determination? From the two presenters, two departments, you can then ask them the area that you wanted to be heard. But at the same time, Madam Chair, I'm sure you are aware that that presentation, we don't have it in our
what we do is that we just notify employees when we give notice that by this time, because we've got the first part that indicates that who are the people who are going to reach the age of 65. We do that on a quarterly basis to check on them. And then what we do, we inform the managers, because most of our employees are in court, to say just so-and-so will be reaching 65, the compulsory retirement age of 65, please notify her. But not necessarily going to the what the act of the pension law says, because that's not our law. We only implement the law as it is. So we just notify our employees, but to say by this time you'll be having so many years of service or whatever, because once the person is admitted in the pension, we take it if he or she is admitted. We just notify the person of the age of retirement in terms of our internal department.
Let's get it from
Thank you, Chairperson. Basically, we have what we call client liaison officers, and we further have regional offices across the country which liaise with human resource offices of all government employers. And further to that, we provided human resource officers within governmental departments with information, detailed information relating to retirement or exit processes or reasons which might differ from one employee to the other. And that guideline, it's actually a manual. It provides in detail what...
Maybe in the interest of time, let's be specific on this one of fun.
Yeah, basically, yes. our role is that we have informed all governmental department employers, and they have that information as to what benefits are payable and at what is the required period of savings relating to additional purchase of savings. They are all aware of it.
You are saying in case of Ms. Van Riade, you notify the human resource of Department of Justice?
No, we don't await the withdrawal form to be sent to us to notify. We have already given them prior information. We've pre-educated the human resource officers of all these benefits and how the rules apply and all the related implications.
I seem not to get your point here. I wanted you to be, you know, open, clear. Tell us in this specific case, what have you done in relate to Van Heerden? Are you confirming that the Department of Justice was notified about the implication of last 3 months? What is the situation?
What happens is that once we receive the withdrawal form, once a member has exited from savings, our mandate is to process payment, right? And the turnaround time we have is that the payment of benefits should be made within 60 days. So once we receive withdrawal forms, we no longer liaise with the employer, because we are given instructions by the employer that this employee is exiting from savings. The reasons are retirement. This is the period of service that the member has served with the employer, and we process the payment. We, at that stage, we do not liaise with the employer, because we've given them prior information so that they can advise all employees of different forms of retirement, different types of benefits payable based on different types of periods of service. So we anticipate that by the time we receive the form, the employer and the employee is well aware of benefits payable.
Maybe it comes back to the Department of Justice. Have you notified this particular person about the difference of 3 months to have this full benefit of 10 years?
Thank you, Chair. I've indicated previous when I responded to say that. Our role in the process is to when the person, we notify the employees when they are about to retire so that they cannot stay for a long time before they get their pension after retirement. We notify them of the time that they are going to this, at this, by this time, you'll be reaching the compulsory retirement date. And then that's why you see in before in my presentation, I indicated that the manager, I think by February, then she has already started the process of asking the employee to complete the necessary
process. I'm sure that the issue here, it is, was at any given stage, any of you who have been trained by DEF informed this particular employee of the department to say, you are about to reach 65 years, which is a compulsory retirement, but you are 3 months less than to have the 10 years. Have you ever communicated this information to them?
No, the issue of 9 years, 9 months was never communicated to this person. We only indicated to her that the 68 of 65 10 years is to complete the next time. As to the implications or the amount that we going to have, so that's what I'm asking.
Honorable Mdak.
Thank you, Chairperson. After receiving M414, have you investigated that she received all the information that you were mentioning here, that you give them information prior that is saying, we are employing you now, so we are expecting this and that from you as the department. And number two, have you made a follow-up from the HR? Are you sure that HR has given her an information, or you are just telling us the procedure that she is supposed to, when you are employing her, she's supposed to get this and that? Have you made the follow-up and make sure that she has received that information? Because if she knew this, we're not supposed to be sitting here and talking about it. Thank you.
Thank you. As I indicated initially, that we, at a stage when we receive withdrawal form, our mandate is to process the payment. But prior to that, the reason we inform, or we actually provide all the necessary information with skilled human resource officers of each employer, that these are the different types of benefits payable with different types of exits and so on, is to ensure that all employees can access that information, can easily access that information and verify with the human resource employer. At the same time, we have a call center that's available where a member can actually inquire about different types of benefits or what would be payable upon my retirement. This is my pension number. What is payable when I actually exit from service, that is, while still in service. Now, we do not have an obligation to, once we receive forms, to liaise with the member again, because we expect the employer to have submitted all the necessary documentation to us. And at that time, the mandate that is, it means that the employer and the employee, who's our member, now mandates us to pay. As to whether are there any discrepancies would only arise if the documents that we have are incomplete or there's missing information that we require for us to finalize the payment. But at the point, at the time we receive withdrawal form, it's not our obligation nor a mandate to liaise with the employee or the employer to find out whether is there any clarity seeking questions, or is there any queries that they would want to raise with us, because at that time there's no queries. We seem to find all the documents in order, because on a daily basis we do receive withdrawal forms where members exit with less than 10 years of service.
Honorable Kumar.
Thanks, Chairperson. I wish we would have enough time to hear more about this matter, because there are a number of things that seem to be not clear as to whether the particular person we're dealing with had enough time to be, I mean, informed on proper procedures. I was listening to the first speaker when she was saying you could not be, you make the application after you have exceeded the pension, the service of employment. That would mean the applicant should be able to be informed, or should be knowing very well that he would not be able to purchase that 3 months after the exceeded. That should be clear to her if she was informed. And for information's sake, on the presentation, page 12 of the first presenter, there's something written that if Ms. Van Reden is authorized to purchase the service of which I guess is 3 months that she's interested in purchasing, she would owe the GEPF 131,000. That would mean if she is now unauthorized to purchase that particular 3 months, she would not be able to responsible or owe the 131,000. Does that referring to what I'm saying to get an understanding? Thanks.
I think what is meant to be conveyed there is that if the committee approved the application for the recognition of the non-pension, the additional 3 months of service, and then she was eligible to purchase that service, notwithstanding what is currently stated in the rule, in the GEP rules, based on what, on the lump sum amount that she was already paid, as Mr. Malloy explained in greater detail in his presentation, based on the lump sum payment that she was already paid last year, and calculating which was 194,000 rand, and the gratuity that she would be entitled to receive as a person with 10 years service, and the monthly annuity payments that she would have been entitled to up from the time she retired up until to date. The GPAA calculated that she has already received 131,000 rand more than what she would have been entitled to receive up to this point. And so she would have to repay that excess amount back to the GEPF in order to be able to receive an annuity. Can you confirm that, Mr. Malloy?
The rule 10.4 was actually intended to allow members purchase service while they're still in the employ of the employer, because it would allow them to determine what the amount that they'll have to pay to purchase that service. And once they accept the quotation given by the GEPF, then they would also determine the period in which they would pay out that purchase of service amount, deducted by the employer on a monthly basis. So it doesn't burden the member monetary-wise to purchase that service they desire to purchase. Now, that's why the rule allows that a member can purchase service while still in service, so that they are not burdened. Now, in Mrs. Van Reden's case, it would be burdensome for her to expect her to pay back the 131,000, and further pay another purchase of service amount, which would be for the three-month duration, which would still have to be payable for her to be in the same in a position that she would have desired to be prior to exiting service.
Okay. I think Honourable Sasibo, you will be followed by Gareth, but I'm still worried. This thing of whose responsibility was to make sure that this person, Ms. Van Reden, knows about this provision of the law. Because that particular person maybe I should disclose. It is not the committee which should decide whether you pay or not. Your own, you know, proof should tell you whether you have done unjust to this particular person. And if it was unjust, you yourself, you'll have to go back and correct it. Correcting it, you would then also deal with the person who misled, you know, misrepresents facts and caused you to pay an additional 101.1, which was not supposed to be paid because you did not give the information. That deserved to be given. But maybe before, Sosibo, can I allow Gareth to speak?
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, members and Chairperson and members from the department. If I could shed some light on the issue. In the facts, I don't know if the department have received these information packs as well, but in the facts that the members have received, there's an affidavit from the manager, from Ms. Van Leder, Van Oteren's manager. It's not numbered now, but it is the affidavit in this pack over here. It says affidavit at the top. It's very close after the yellow page. At the bottom, there's a stamp of the African Police Service.
Signed by
Baba Yuanis. It's just after the yellow page. A few pages after the yellow page. I don't know if everyone else has got that document. This is an affidavit by the office manager of Ms. Van Leder van Oostwald, in which she says that in January of 2010, Ms. Van Oostwald approached her as the office manager about the pension money that will be payable to her on seeing that she'd be turning 65 in June of 2010. That office manager then called the regional office of HR, and the response that was received was that she can go on pension on the very same day because she's already a pensioner according to the system. Now, this would obviously then mean June of 2010. According to this affidavit as well, there's the information relayed from HR to the office manager, Anna Sanlieta, is that she has served 10 years in the department and she will receive a lump sum as well as a monthly amount. Then furthermore, they questioned again whether she will receive the lump sum as well as a monthly amount, and the response that was given was yes, that she will receive this amount. She says in paragraph 6 that there was further and intensive discussion and the document was then forwarded to Ms. Van Leder, and then she completed the document and she handed them back to the regional HR officer. Now, I think this will answer some of the questions that the members do have. However, Ms. Bednagiosi raises a very important issue whether Ms. Van Leder and Oster is in the position to repay if the committee does find in favour of the petitioner, whether she's in a position to pay back that large amount, given that now new calculations will have to be done. And that is something that the committee will then have to decide in consultation with the petitioner. But it's very important what the representative from National Treasury says, that is she in a position to repay that amount?
Thank you, Chairperson. I was just checking, I was going to propose that because it raises so many questions, let's be giving enough time to consult with the member, Mrs. Van Bak.
Yes.
Yeah, Van Rede. So that after all the information that you have received, so that we are out of the all these documents, then, including the document for your document because we don't have it, so that we can take our decision after that. If there will be any need for requesting the department to come again, then we'll do so. But if we are satisfied, then they will still
us by not requesting them to come back to us.
I think that is in order. We will stop this deliberation now. But hopefully, the issue at stake here is its communication. GEPF have communicated to the human resources. You have workshopped them. You have taught them. But they themselves, can they prove to us whether this person can they, you know, openly said it's in the known of this particular provision? And I doubt that may not be, you know, openly said by any one of you. We will take this while you are going back to make your check whether the level of communication can you sing and said, you know, openly, Miss Van Riede was, you know, in a known of this provision. She deliberately chose to retire despite knowing that. Looking at this affidavit, I'm sure this person is employed by which you are DOJ CD. So I'm not sure whether you are aware of this affidavit. Have you checked the authenticity of it? I think we will determine whether we still need you back to come and clarify, you know, unclarified questions. But for now, let's take it that you have given us the information we're looking for, and that you are also be notified that you could not, you know, clarify whether this particular person was, you know, individually in a known of what she was supposed to know. Because for her to would have been taken a well-informed decision, you should have been convinced that she's aware of this particular provision we're talking about, of Rule 14.2.11. I think we'll determine our position if the committee will think it's still necessary to communicate with you. We will do likewise. But thank you very much for coming and providing us with the information you have given to us. Thank you, honorable members. I know you would have been in oversight somewhere, but you prioritized to come and do your work in this precinct today. Thank you for doing that. And I think the meeting compelled to be adjourned without, you know, even wasting any further time. We have overlapped into other people's time. We might be chatting. Thank you very much. Until we meet again.
I think, however, we are aware that we do not have a forum in terms of looking at our minutes, but I think it should be recorded that we should be looking at minutes, but because of a quorum, we couldn't be.
I thought
thank you for that. We kept this today. We did it because we couldn't have a quorum. But not necessarily a quorum time. Time did not permit that. I think quorum might not be the reason. Time is the reason.